in the Utah District, Salt Lake City, one of four judges there. This was my brainchild to have this panel and structure this way. I'm sure all of you have heard, but when you're appointed as a new judge, you're sent off to something called baby judge school, and you get to go twice. And it is indeed an interesting experience to learn how to transition from being an advocate to a judicial officer. And it just happened to be that Casey was appointed shortly before me, and I think, Judge Parker and Judge McNamara was appointed shortly after I was, and that we were all together in sharing that baby judge experience. And I thought it would be helpful and interesting to the bar to give you an opportunity to meet with us, get to know us a little better. You know, and this was geared towards consumers, but I can see there's some commercial practitioners here. But, you know, I noticed that the commercial practitioners, they'll get over in court and they'll spend hours and days and sometimes weeks in front of the judge. And the consumer practitioners, it's usually fairly quick, you know, law in motion, confirmation. We may only get to see you in front of us for a few moments, minutes. Maybe 10 minutes at most at any given time, whereas the consumer, the commercial attorneys, when you spend days with someone, you feel like you know them pretty well. So I want to give the consumer attorneys an opportunity to get to know us, and if appropriate, to get to know you a little better. So I invited, I'm from Utah, Judge Parker from Wyoming, and Judge McNamara from Colorado, and to give this, take an opportunity to kind of talk about a little bit about our background, a little bit about our judicial philosophies, and really more focus on, as new judges, this experience is new to us, and having us as your judges is new to you, and to maybe give you the opportunity to ask them some questions, as I mentioned earlier. Now, if I have this factual case, how are you going to rule before me? This isn't what that is. But we have some observation, we have some comments, share with you, so give you an opportunity to perhaps better understand our judicial philosophy so that you can better represent your clients and better present your cases before us when you have the opportunity to appear before us. I'll start with myself as my background. I clerked for the bankruptcy, I'm going to go back even further. I took a bankruptcy class that was taught by Judge Ralph Mabee. Some of you may know him. And it was one of those things, I was in law school, and they said, well, bankruptcy impacts everything, so everyone should know a little bit about bankruptcy. And I happened to take a bankruptcy class with Ralph Mabee, who at the time was a sitting judge, excellent practitioner, made bankruptcy sound like the most sexy, exciting thing since James Bond. But it really wasn't my career goal. So I was clerking for a law firm, and of course someone walks in and says, hey, we have a secured lender, and the guy just filed for bankruptcy. Who knows anything about bankruptcy? Well, I've taken a class from Judge Mabee that you're a bankruptcy guy. You're our expert. And that really started me on the path to where I am today, because I subsequently clerked for a bankruptcy court down in Southern California, worked for some large law firms, primarily representing Chapter 7 and Chapter 11 trustees. And I considered myself a litigator. So my involvement in the consumer area was very limited. But an opportunity came up an opening came available with the Chapter 13 office. The U.S. trustee called me and said, gee, why have you thought about applying for this? And my real response was, why would I ever want to be the Chapter 13 trustee? Well, they eventually talked me into it. I accepted the position. I served in that position for about 17 years. I administered about 70,000 Chapter 13 cases. I interviewed literally thousands of debtors. I've dealt with dozens, maybe hundreds of different debtors' counsel. And I think that has given me a very good perspective on, and as the trustee, you know, one of my statutory charges is to assist debtors in completing their Chapter 13 plan. So debtors would call my office fairly often. Of course, I couldn't give them legal advice, but I did spend a fair amount of time communicating with them, and I think that has given me some appreciation for the challenges of debtors' counsel representing individuals who end up in bankruptcy, sometimes through no fault of their own, sometimes through the occurrence of a very catastrophic, unfortunate event, but more often than not, because the complexities of our current society are such that individuals have a hard time fully understanding their financial situation, limitations, and where the resources are going. Anyway, so that's my background as a bankruptcy practitioner. And I enjoy being on the bench very much, but it is a very different perspective. We'll take a chance to maybe share our individual philosophies, but I wanted to give maybe start with Judge McNamara and get your background and whatever else you want to share to the attendees.
Sure. So my name is Tom McNamara. I was appointed to the bench in the District of Colorado on March 23rd, 2015, which time passes. I mean, it seems like only yesterday, but now it's almost 2 years. So I'm no longer the newest judge. So Judge Anderson, you might have made a mistake, and Judge Rosania is really the newest judge here. But sometimes I still feel new. I first was involved in insolvency-related issues at the very beginning of my career, and I can remember being in the courthouse with Ed Perlmutter back in 1990, I think, and so it's terrific to see him here. For probably 5 years or so, I worked very extensively with a former bankruptcy judge, Judge Glenn Keller. Some of you remember Judge Keller, and worked on a number of insolvency cases as well as SIPC liquidations. Blinder Robinson was probably the biggest SIPC liquidation at that time, has since been dwarfed. But over the years, I guess I strayed away from the insolvency area, more into commercial litigation. And for the last 10 or so years before joining the bench, my practice was primarily international dispute resolution, mostly in the natural resources space, oil, gas, and mining, with a heavy emphasis on Latin America. And so I came into the position with virtually no experience on the consumer side, except for I do think I did a couple of pro bono cases in the early 90s. So to that extent, and there are some throughout the system, and Judge Weedoff is one who didn't have a lot of that experience. But I've got to say that for me, I've really enjoyed the consumer practice and learning about Chapter 13 and Chapter 7. It's as complicated or more so than the large commercial practice in Chapter 11, and I feel like there's a direct connection on people's lives that are coming in the courtroom, whether they're represented by counsel or pro se as well. And so it's been an area that has been really, I've been surprised at the interest I've had in that, and I want to learn more from folks here. I also want to say how much I appreciate the bar in Colorado. We have a terrific bar presenting a lot of interesting and unique issues to keep me busy every day. In terms of judicial philosophy, I think that was something that Judge Anderson hinted at or requested that we talk about that a little bit. I'm not sure I have a judicial philosophy, at least in a sort of a political type sense. I'm looking at, what does the statute say? That's what I do whenever I get a case. I look at the statute, I look at the rule, I look at our local rules, and we try our best to apply the facts and the law within that framework. Because of my lack of experience in the area, I probably have more questions on all that. Like, as an example, and this might be something that we can talk about a little bit later, I remember on day two or three in the courtroom, I had a hearing on what's called a motion to reinstate a case, which I had never heard of that before. And so I had the lawyer for the debtor who was trying to reinstate the case. And I said, well, what is the statutory basis for this reinstatement that you're asking for? I was met with a puzzled look, I think. And the same question on the rules basis. But those are questions that I try to focus on as I look at cases that come in front of me. So there's a quick summary about my background. Judge Parker?
Thank you. So I was, yes, only junior for probably a couple weeks, I think, before Judge Anderson got sworn in. So I got to become a senior judge pretty quick. And I'm getting more senior by the day, it seems like. I am the chief judge, so I get and I always wonder, like, when they're talking about all these committees getting these things done, and I'm like, how are they getting to that? I can't even start to. I'm like, oh, they have a chief judge that assigns out those responsibilities. I get to assign them to myself. So I am originally from Colorado, grew up in Colorado, but I went to Wyoming for undergrad and law school. I had a business degree from the University of Wyoming, but I knew from being a kid that I wanted to be a lawyer. So to me, college was just kind of a stepping stone. Was always interested in, obviously, business-related transactions. Tax was my passion, which the dean of the law school made a lot of fun of me for that. But when I graduated, I didn't want to step foot in a courtroom. I wanted to be a transactional attorney, do income tax, didn't want any part of a courtroom. Was able to go to the Attorney General's office and represent the Department of Revenue, so I got to do tax work, but not having an income tax, it was a different type of tax work. But I soon learned that my favorite place to be was in the courtroom. I loved to be litigating, I loved argument in front of the Supreme Court. I just loved everything about it. I was with the AG's office for almost 16 years, and I was in the revenue section the entire time. But I did, the advantage we had in the Attorney General's office in Wyoming, at least, is when you didn't have as much to do, you could take on, you know, work from other sections, learn other areas. So I think I did probably like a dozen criminal arguments to the Wyoming Supreme Court. No interest in criminal law. It was just something new and different. I got to go down and do a tort action in the litigation division. You know, so I got to do a lot of different things. I was probably the primary person that handled bankruptcy, though, for the Attorney General's office, because I, being the tax nerd I was, enjoyed it. You know, everyone else didn't want any part of it. We didn't do a lot, though, for the state, because, as you know, generally the state has to be taken care of or nothing's going to happen. So there really was very little opportunity to get into court. So the position came open. I thought, I'll try. You know, I love what I had. This is the advantage I had when I think that I have when I applied. I loved my current job. I didn't really have any desire to leave my current job. So it was kind of the best of both worlds. It'd be great if I got the job. If I didn't, I'm okay where I'm at. So I think that made probably the process a little easier for me. Like Judge McNamara, I had not a huge bankruptcy background. I had taught it through a paralegal program, so I knew it on an academic level. But I had soon come to realize, knowing it academically and real life, it's worlds apart. I mean, it just really is worlds apart. I am lucky that I have the Colorado bench. They have kind of adopted me and taken me under the wing. Well, I don't know. I got forced on them. Let me tell you, let's say that. As part of the decision to hire Wyoming, because Wyoming was kind of one of those small states, like, do we really need a bankruptcy judge? Our 10th Circuit judge, Judge Phillips, and our chief judge, I think, really went to bat for it. But as part of the agreement was that if they filled the position, then I would be taking on Colorado cases. I was told I would have a year before that would happen. I think Judge Romero called me about 2 months into it and said, we've got to make this happen. So I would say probably a year now I've had Colorado cases. They're only Chapter 7s out of Larimer County. So my first trial, if it does go, will be the end of February, and we're actually going to do it in Colorado. The first trial I was supposed to have for Colorado, they were actually going to come to Cheyenne and do it because it was closer for the parties, but that went away. So it doesn't add. I try to tell people that by taking on the Chapter 7s in Colorado, it doesn't add a lot of work for me because I don't see most of it, but it adds a lot of work for my staff and sometimes the clerk's office because they're the one trying to coordinate access to the docket and that type of thing. As far as a judicial policy, it's hard to kind of I don't know how to exactly frame it, and I don't really think about it, you know, when you're doing stuff, but it always, the concern I had coming into Wyoming is that we have a very small bar. We have a bar that if the probably three or four primary debtor attorneys retired, which they could at any day, we would have no bar. I mean, there is nobody to step in and take those cases. So as, when I have done stuff, my goal has tried to be, how do I attract younger attorneys to do it? The problem is it's not lucrative. You cannot have a practice in Wyoming that's just bankruptcy. It's just not going to happen. So how do we make it easy for them to get involved? How do we make it less scary for them to come into a court they don't know, using a vocabulary they don't know? So we've been focused on that. We've worked with Colorado to try to get the federal advocate system set up. It's still kind of in the stages, but that will get some exposure to some of the younger attorneys. We do have a bankruptcy section just started, so I'll put a plug in for that. If you want to join the bankruptcy section in Wyoming, if you're licensed in Wyoming, we're trying to get that off the ground, and I think that will help younger, newer attorneys because now they're going to be able to sign up, get on the email listserv, and have access to very seasoned attorneys who are very willing to help younger attorneys. My other concern is getting people access to the bankruptcy court, because again, if you don't have attorneys that can do it, you know, most of you probably know Wyoming is very big, right? So our primary debtors attorneys are in the major cities. They're in Cheyenne, they're in Casper. So you have somebody that's in a very small town. You know, if they're in bankruptcy, they may not be the most sophisticated person. They may not know how to use the internet. They may not know how to call, you know, that the state bar exists. They're not going to know what that is. And so I think there's a lot of attorneys in Wyoming, or people in Wyoming, that are not taking advantage of bankruptcy because they don't know how to find an attorney. They don't know how to get access to an attorney. I also think I've had people in my courtroom that have told me, I can't afford to be in bankruptcy. You know, they're there because they sold off an asset that they were supposed to turn over to the trustee. Well, they had to do that to pay their rent to stay in their house. So my goal, I think, is to make the process as simple as possible. I want to make it as easy for everyone as possible because I think that keeps the cost down. It makes it more accessible. But I do strive to stay within the parameters of the rules and procedure that are required. So sometimes it's a tough balancing act to ensure that we're handling the process properly, but trying to not rack up all the attorney's fees and costs as we go.
Great. So I neglected to state my judicial philosophy. I tend to create paradigms, models that help me analyze problems so that I can, when I say this is this problem, and I'll look at this and this and walk through it. To me, that's helped make it easier to make decisions. And so these are some of my paradigms I have in connection with the judiciary. And one, I believe in the separation of powers. Congress legislates, executive branch executes, and my job is to interpret and enforce the laws as passed by Congress. So the bankruptcy code allows me to do certain things, it requires me to do certain things, and it even prohibits me from doing certain things. And so to the extent I can, a common example that comes up all the time is the situation where debtors get their credit counseling certificate, maybe even minutes after they file their petition. Sometimes hours, sometimes days.
Sometimes
I have very strong personal opinions about the worth of requiring a debtor to take a credit counseling course before filing. I have never seen, and if you recall...
What are the opinions?
My personal opinion.
Okay.
But, it required debtors to meet with someone to see if there was a way they could do an out-of-court workout, or if possible, put together a plan of repayment that they were supposed to submit with the petition. As I told you, I probably certainly tens of thousands of cases. I have never, ever, ever seen a proposed plan of reorganization. And I do not think there is one person who has taken that credit counseling course and said, gee, I don't really need to file bankruptcy. Now, let me back up. I think the financial management course that debtors must take to obtain their discharge is very beneficial. I've had debtors tell me, and it's one of these things you go, this should be taught in high school or college, but they go, I didn't know that credit added $20,000 or $30,000 to the cost of my car. I didn't realize that. That's new to me. And so I think it does help them. The intent was to prevent them from refiling the course. But anyway, back to my point. I don't like the credit counseling course, and I think it's sad when somebody gets it, but I think the code requires and says they don't qualify for chapter four, whatever bankruptcy relief. They haven't complied with that. So as difficult as it is, I tend to dismiss cases unless they can make some other advantage of the extension. So that's an example of where I may personally disagree, but I think that's what the code requires, so that's probably. There's lots of areas where I have lots of discretion to exercise. And there are lots of areas, especially in light of recent comments regarding jurisdiction, that I need to be careful that I don't rule on issues over which, and that's what Wellness really said, you know, you may have statutory authority to make this ruling, so it's a court proceeding, but you don't have constitutional authority to make this ruling, and I want to be careful to avoid that. So that's my philosophy on that. As to debtors, actually as to all parties, if I think a debtor is proceeding in good faith and has a sincere intent to reorganize or is acting in good faith and is trying to comply with the requirements of the code, I will try to accommodate that debtor to the extent I can under the code to facilitate their completion of this bankruptcy process and to achieve a discharge. However, because I believe that a discharge is an enormous benefit. I mean, you think about that. We're allowing people to walk away from tens of thousands, sometimes hundreds of thousands of debt. And I always remember, that's a debt that somebody else is not collecting on and that may indeed be contributing to their own financial downfall. But it's an enormous benefit. And Chapter 13 is certainly more rigorous with its 3 to 5 year requirement, but Chapter 7 really requires very little of debtors of what they must do in order to obtain a discharge. And so if I think a debtor is proceeding in good faith, I will try to give them an opportunity to make a course correction, provide a document that they may have missed. But it doesn't take long to reach a point where I say, you are not proceeding in good faith. There are responsibilities that come with the enormous benefit of obtaining a discharge. And if you're really not willing to comply with the responsibilities, I'm not going to facilitate the entry of the discharge on your behalf. So I guess I'd like to think I give everyone, to the extent I can, one opportunity, maybe two, to try and correct it. But if they're not going to comply, then I dismiss the case or deny the discharge or not confirm the plan, et cetera, et cetera. So that, in a general sense, is how I tend to view things. I'll make one last comment, also on one of my paradigms. I believe strongly in the adversary system. I believe the best, as a judge, I can only make the best decision if the issue is, you heard me say this, passionately, intelligently, competently, adequately litigated by two competent parties. And that is very helpful, I think the other judges would agree, because you come in with a certain perspective, and the other side, you start going, oh yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Oh, okay, that's making sense. And it really can help you conceptualize this and say, okay, I think this is where it's at. So I believe lawyers play just a critical role in my ability to make good decisions, that it's impossible to make a good decision based on bad or incomplete information. And so as lawyers, I don't want to say disappointed, sometimes frustrated. It's like, here's your opportunity to tell me why your position is correct. You're not taking full advantage of that opportunity, and I fear that I may not be making the best decision. I've spoken too much. This is now your opportunity. I mean, we have some questions we can bring up, but I hope, what are your questions to us as your new judges? Maybe what has changed? You know, you've had some excellent jurists on the bench for a long time, so as Utah Judge Thurman has been there for 16 years now, but we are the new kids in town, so to speak. and we have some of our own ideas. We try to keep things same. But what are some things you would like to ask from us, either collectively or individually, so that you might be better attorneys as you practice before us?
So this was supposed to be a dialogue today. So let me kick it off with a question to you guys to answer. It'll start making you think. So bad thing about being in the judiciary, at least, is that we don't get feedback, right? We don't get to get a survey that says this is what you're doing bad or this is what you're doing great, right? So we don't get that kind of feedback. So this is our opportunity. So we were asking yesterday, are you considered debtor friendly or creditor friendly? What's the rumor out there? So we want to know, what is the rumor out there for the new judges on the bench? And I'm not holding anyone to any one position, but I'm just curious, is there a rumor out there? I mean, that's the first thing you hear when I would practice. Judge McNiff is pro-debtor. That's anytime someone brought up the bankruptcy judge, he's pro-debtor. So I know that happens out there. So come on, what's the...
I'll share something. Well, first, is Judge Mazzania in the room? So this is about Judge Mazzania. So I had not been in front of him very often, but I kind of heard that he was quite debtor friendly, and I represent creditors. So I hadn't been in front of him enough. I hadn't really made up my mind, but I have rules that I have to follow, and arguments pretty much the same. So. But last week I happened to be in front of him, and my client had filed an objection and a motion to allow it to be filed late. And it was filed maybe 3 or 4 days after the objection deadline, and opposing counsel had objected to that. And Judge Rosania says, in the meantime, I'm kind of working it out, so I think we're going to stipulate this. But me and my opposing counsel are going to come to an agreement. So we ultimately probably aren't going to have to litigate this late filed objection. But Judge Rosania said, and I almost fell over, I feel like in this jurisdiction, we really go above and beyond to bend over backwards to let debtors file things late, and we allow that. And I really feel that a lot of times we should extend that same courtesy to creditors.
You're happy about that?
Oh my God, I'm so happy. I was like, oh. So I feel like whatever rumors are out there, don't stick to them, because they just can't always be true.
Yeah, and every case is different, and we know that. But we were just curious when we were meeting yesterday about if there is a perception out there, because I think it helps us if we know there's a perception to evaluate what are we doing. We don't want to have that perception. We don't want to be pro debtor, pro creditor.
It was such a strange thing this morning when I heard one of the commentators around the table like this talk about the socialist. What was it?
The state of Minnesota.
Minnesota, yeah. I know those judges in Minnesota. They're not socialists.
Well, I got some feedback. And kind of a funny story about 4 or 5 months ago. I had a motion from a creditor, I think, who attached as part of the motion a series of emails. And I tend to like read everything that comes by my desk. You never know what you might find. I mean, there might be something very interesting in the motion or the attachments. And so one of the attachments, and God only knows why it was in there, was the debtor's communication with his counsel, and the counsel's communication with the debtor. And you think maybe that would be attorney-client privilege. It was only a few sentences before. I had to kind of figure out what it was before I could. I wouldn't have looked at it if I had known it was attorney-client privilege. But he did advise his client that I was the worst judge in the District of Colorado. He goes, "You drew the worst judge." And I was like, wow, that must be, he's on point, good. And then he goes,
competition too.
Yeah, there he goes. And then he goes, "And everyone knows that he only rules in favor of creditors. This is the advice from..." Well, that lawyer was in for a big surprise as I ruled in his favor. Of course I ruled in favor. No, but I don't think of cases in the terms of trying to favor a creditor or a debtor. And when you get a comment like that, I did go back and ask to have an analysis of you know, the last month before I got that inquiry to see, how do I come out on that, debtor or creditor? Because I'm not trying to come out one way or another. And I think it was maybe a little bit more even-keeled than had been suggested in the email.
One of the things judges should know is that the Federal Judicial Center will do an anonymous survey of judges in your district, asking them a whole series of questions about the way the judge has been performing. And that's a particular benefit to any judge who might like to be reappointed, because one of the surest obstacles to reappointment is engendering hostility in the bar. So finding out where you might have areas of improvement is very useful. And the FJC is just scrupulous in making sure that that communication goes only to you. And you want to find out, what do people think? That's a way to do it.
And here's our chance, too. Come on.
Yeah. If I can help as a practitioner, doing this 25 years more or less, not with any of you, so I feel free to just... don't read so much into what that lawyer said to his client, because what we love as practitioners is certainty of result, or at least knowing to some degree when I can tell a client, you got the hanging judge. You better, you know, client control is everything for attorneys. And if I'm able to tell a client, hey, I need you here and I need you to do this, and you can't even, I don't even want you a day late on that darn plan paper because you drew this judge, blah, 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 blah. That's not information I want to share with that judge, but that helps me with client control. And at the same time, the certainty of result. I know in our district what judges tend to be more debtor friendly, but then so do the creditors. We get stuff done. The creditors know which ones are more creditor friendly. And so, you know, that one, maybe I got to vent a little bit more. We had judges this is the Eastern District of Michigan. And so, Judge, we don't know even a lot of those judges. We had a judge that routinely would take the bench with, there might be 25 cases that were up. He was done with them in 10 minutes, maybe 15 minutes. And you remember that he's retired now, but it was just like, all right, well, you better have your ducks in a row. If you can settle this, that's even better. Certainty of result. The worst thing for us is, gee, this judge is all over the map. I don't know.
I would concur with that. I remember our toughest judge, and I mean that literally, Judge Bolden, was very tough with every requirement and every deadline and every, and didn't hesitate to dismiss cases. But you knew what her standard was, and you knew what she would accept and what she wouldn't. And you're right, as a practitioner, it made it very easy to prepare and to advise your client and to get the desired result. And you're right, I think as judges, we want to have some consistency. But, you know, it's interesting, we were talking yesterday, the three of us, we met for breakfast and were talking about this. And this issue of, you get this case, you have a very sympathetic debtor, a very sympathetic situation, and you would like to make an accommodation that is perhaps outside the norm. And you go, I'd like to do that, but, and I assume this is true of Colorado, there is a debtor's listserv of emails that goes around, and you know if you make that ruling, they do it in Colorado, we have the audio recordings available on the docket, and you can just click and listen. So you know anyone and everyone can listen to what you say. So you think, wait a minute, but I want the whole world knowing that I'm allowing this, because what was once the exception quickly becomes the rule. And so you try to be, you want to be consistent in your application, even though the equities of the case might really say, I want to do something different.
We're in an interesting spot right now with the retirement of Judge Tolman. His case is not being reassigned to other judges. We have a lot of those cases that are kind of in limbo right now. When we're looking to tee up an issue or see if we should tee it up, it's going to make a big difference if that goes in front of Judge McNamara's proposed to Judge Romero, just procedurally on some issues where some judges allow certain procedures, others won't. And so deciding how we're going to go forward, it's really highlighted how different all the judges are, not necessarily better friendly or creditor friendly, just more along the lines of procedurally, how you go about things in everybody's courts, how the hearings go. A confirmation hearing in Judge McNamara's court is definitely different than a Monday docket on Judge Romero's court, where it's more or less there's still issues, okay, they're resolved, no hearing, okay, let's move on, as opposed to a little bit more intensive, fact-intensive, or legal I think the Judge Tolman cases have been interesting.
Well, I'll share a little secret. When I was a trustee, we had three judges, and we would assign three staff attorneys. And first, a question always was, when an issue came up and was brought up to me, which meant it was a big issue, who's the judge? And not that there was, you're right, a large divergence of approach, but it certainly helped in analyzing. I've got to give Judge Thurman great credit, Judge Mosher's continued to make a real effort in the Utah court to be more consistent and uniform as to certainly procedural issues and handling them the same. But judges are an independent lot, and they are going to do what they're going to do, what they're going to administer their docket the way they see fit and think best.
Well, but I do want to just comment on uniformity, too, because I think it's very important for efficiency and economy, for the lawyers, for the debtors, to have some level of uniformity. And we may fail on that, but I think uniformity at a national level is important, and why I likely will favor, in the end, some kind of a national plan. But also locally, there can be uniformity. And I would probably suggest that, and I know several of our colleagues from Colorado are here, but the reason that we don't have uniformity is not that we all dislike each other's procedures and so forth. There's a lack of time, and I would suppose that some of the judges have been doing it for a while. They haven't looked at my procedures. I haven't maybe looked at their procedures as closely as I should. And so maybe that's a place where we can improve by, at least on that level, trying to make things more common. I think there are some efforts at that with the local rules committee and maybe some common procedures in adversary proceedings, for example. But Chapter 13 is possible.
Interesting at that luncheon yesterday, one of the things that really stuck in my mind, so to speak, was that our brains change as we have different experiences. And as new judges, we are having lots of new experiences all the time now, and I see my brain changing. So what we may do today may not be what we do after some experience.
I've got to tell you a story about my first becoming a judge. You were here, and I knew nothing about bankruptcy. Completely ignorant. There's a reason why the Seventh Circuit would choose somebody like me to be a bankruptcy judge. We don't have time for that. But I thought, because I didn't know about bankruptcy, I should visit the courtrooms of all the sitting judges. And there were six judges in Chicago at that time, all in the same floor, so it wasn't really hard to go from one courtroom to the other. And I came up with who I thought ran the courtroom the best. I can tell you right now, it was David Korb. He was a wonderful guy. But what impressed me was his willingness truly to listen to the lawyers who were appearing before him. When he was not bored, he was not distracted, he was really making eye contact, listening to what they had to say and responding appropriately. I thought, boy, that's something that I want to do. On the other hand, I had no idea what the procedures were that he was employing or what the issues were that he was deciding. From the moment I became a judge, I had to kind of come up with my own. And here's the key. Never in 28 years did I ever again visit the courtrooms of the other judges to see how they were doing things. Now that I knew what procedures they were actually putting into effect, what kinds of rules they were making. And I wonder if judges would tolerate it, if it would be okay to visit the courtrooms of other judges. Now that you know what are the things that you have to do, you could see what that judge was actually doing. And maybe, as you were saying, Judge Anderson, get some ideas that you could implement in your own practice.
Some of the other things, these type of seminars here are, I can't impress how important they are to us on the bench. We try to talk to one another. We see something that if Judge Brown has something I really, really like, there's a fairly good chance I'm going to steal it from her chambers and employ it in what I'm doing. And yes, that's the way we work. But a lot of times we get in these type of sessions, practitioners say, okay, I really, really like what Judge McNamara is doing on this type of issue or this type of procedure. And then I'll come back and say, oh, gee, I better see what he's doing or what Judge Brown is doing. And that is, usually for us, but there are five of us, or now four. And it's very easy when you see that somebody says that they really like what this is going on, and you can look at the others easily. It's not like Los Angeles where there's 35 of them, 35 different procedures. So we really do value the input of the practitioners. And if you look at that, Utah is probably the same way because their bar is about the same size, the same size bench. And it's something a lot of times we're different because we just don't know we're different. And once upon a time when we had more money available to the clerk's office, we hired somebody that we hoped were going to be going around and trying to figure out where we actually were different to tell us. As things have gotten tighter, that luxury is gone. So we have to hear it from someone. And the place we hear it from, all of you.
Are there key differences that people would like to raise that maybe we should take a look at?
Some of the ones I'm thinking of, they may be procedural, but they actually do come down, at least to some degree, on how somebody can rule on the law. Procedures, motions to reinstate, you mentioned that one early on. It's going to get a lot more resistance, a motion to reinstate, at least from my experience, you've really looked at it on Rule 59 and 60 grounds. Is there a reason?
Did I do that?
Yeah, correct. And I know some of our other judges automatically reinstate a case, and then you can kind of challenge the reinstatement. And I think that's kind of a difference on the law, as well as motions to whether we can stipulate a minor change or whether a motion to modify needs to be done and go through those procedures. The results of or how we approach those, whether we're going to resolve it through stipulation or resolve it through a motion to modify, it'll depend on which judge we have, which procedure we need to follow. But again, I think that comes down to interpretation of the law. So it's not necessarily something everybody's going to get on the same page with.
It goes beyond that, I think, in a lot of areas. If I have a question, and it's Judge McNamara, and it's a little bit obscure, I expect you will take it under advisement, and in 6 weeks you get an opinion that's 30 pages long. Discuss the history of that.
Take me 6 months.
Issue of law going back to Magna Carta. On the other hand, it's Judge Rosania, it's a similar issue. I expect him to say, well, here's where I'm going, and a week later you get an opinion that's three paragraphs long. You say, okay, same result, but way different opinion. Just in format and tone and the whole way that approach the result, even though the result may be the same. And I think that's been true in Colorado for a very long time, where the judges were all very unique characters at several levels, and certainly in the era where a lot of us earned our spurs, so to speak, with Judge Brumbaugh, Matheson, McGrath, Clark, etc. We knew very well where those judges were coming from on a lot of issues, and we knew very well what the sensitive points were, what arguments you could make, and if it was Judge Brumbaugh, I had a relief from stay motion as a creditor. You trembled because you knew that there was a very good chance he was going to take apart both valuation experts. And you weren't quite sure what you were going to do with that. And you tended to approach those different from another division. If it was Judge Matheson, you know, you'd say, well, gee, you know, I don't know what he's going to do with this, but, you know, there's probably 15 opinions on that. And he'll toe the line on what the statute says. And, you know, I'll sort of treat him like Justice Scalia is on the bench, maybe. Judge Clark, I go in there and say, where is you? And I expect her to say, you know, well, why are we here? Why don't you go out in the hall and resolve this?
I have a question for the judges. To what extent would you take action that is contrary to what appears to be the agreement of all the parties? when would you interject yourself to say that what you're proposing is not supported by the code or is contrary to the code if nobody is objecting?
Judge Brown, you did that on the 3002 issues. The debtor and the trustee would want to stipulate the discharge can enter.
And we found a rash of cases where debtors aren't paying their mortgage payments for years, and it finally comes out at the time they ask for the discharge. And so people want to quick hurry up and let's do a new modification of that mortgage. It's past month 60. You know, I can only have a Chapter 13 plan. It goes 60 months. They've had 60 months. So there are times when, and I always liken the bankruptcy code to a coloring book. You color that so many creative, beautiful ways, you have stand set of lines. And my job is to make sure there's coloring in the lines.
Just to add to that, and I think that Judge Anderson had indicated that one of his values was the adversary system and presenting issues through the adversary system. I agree with that completely. But I think unlike maybe our judges in the district court and the bankruptcy court, there are all a variety of different areas where we have almost like a gatekeeping function. At least that's how I read some of the case law from the Supreme Court. Espinoza, I think that Judge Weedoff, you mentioned earlier today, suggests we're supposed to read the plans. We're supposed to make sure we have like an independent duty to do that and to make sure that there's compliance with the bankruptcy code. It's a real struggle where no one else is raising that issue. And frankly, it would be easier for us to ignore that and just move on as well. But from time to time, I will observe something that I think is just doesn't seem to be right, and then generally ask for additional briefing on that issue, and may raise it on a sui sponte basis, maybe more than others.
Yeah, I tend to be with you more often than I think you appreciate, because there are quite often times if you have issues, there'll be something that pops up that seems painfully obvious is a problem. It hasn't been raised by other parties, and that's when you ask for supplemental briefs on those issues so you can get all of those. I'm sorry, but if two people agree to do something that's not allowed by the code, you can agree all night, and you're not going to get it done. I've got at least my philosophy is I'm paid to enforce the law as written by Congress. If you want to change it, go to Congress. But the fact that you two agree that the law should be changed doesn't change my obligation to enforce the law as written.
I'm just curious, how many of you appeared before Judge Barker who are here? Either my own neighbor or not.
Yeah. There's a big potential
someday. My philosophy is a little bit different in that, depending on how far you want to put it. I mean, if you're really stretching the code and you can't, there may be a reason to step in. Sometimes I figure I'll let you do this, but when you want to come back and enforce it, then you're going to have an issue, because that's going to be, well, can you legally make them do that? So I try not to create those fights when they're not necessary. And I don't think I have that happen very often. Usually with 13s, what I do, if I have a 13, I go back and look at the objection that was made when it wasn't confirmed the first time, and then I look at the changes in the plan to see if that generally addresses what the objections were. I can do that because I have a much smaller caseload. But if I get a plan through with no objection on first time round, I'm not going to go spend time looking at it. I know my trustee, and if there's any reason, the tiniest reason, he asserts objections that aren't even his to assert, he will assert them on behalf of creditors. I mean, so I have faith that if there's a problem, it's going to get raised. Now, someday that's probably going to come back and bite me. The area that I have struggled with the most is when you have a pleading and you have no response. And the pleading on its face just doesn't pass muster. You know, we're recently dealing with an objection to a claim. Well, all the objection said was, I don't owe it. Nothing more. That's it. The creditor didn't respond. Well, is that enough? to deny the claim. I mean, the creditor's not responding. You know, they probably did get current. They were behind a few hundred dollars. Odds are they're current. But, you know, do I just say, nope, you didn't meet your burden because you didn't? I mean, it's a really tough place for me to try to figure out what to do when just prima facie, it's just a little bit lacking. And I have the same issue with defaults. If you file a default, if your complaint doesn't entitle you to relief, you're not going to get relief from me. And I know there is case law out there that says, I don't care if it's a default, it's a default. They get whatever they ask for. And I don't think that's a prevailing philosophy, but I struggle, like I said, when I have these pleadings and there's no response. I don't know why there's no response. You know, it may be just an economic. It's not economical to hire an attorney to file a response. That could be the whole reason. But I don't know, and so I really struggle when the complaining document or whatever it is just on that cusp of maybe not being enough. So that's my biggest.
I wanted to touch on what you mentioned, Judge McNamara, about the gatekeeper function. We talked about this yesterday morning, that we trustees, judges, trustees, and practitioners in general, we all have a charge to maintain the integrity of the bankruptcy system. And when you think about it, that it's the federal statute with which most individuals will have the most direct contact. Their most likely exposure to any federal court is the bankruptcy court. We are the most direct face with most individuals of the federal court system. And the sheer volume of cases that pass through, the district court judges, we did a comparison once, and it's ballpark numbers, but the ratio is essentially right. I think over the year, the Utah court had signed 150,000 orders, which when you think about all the orders we signed to extend and allow, blah, blah, blah. The district court had maybe signed 200 orders. And that's a lot, that's a huge difference, and we need to be careful to maintain the integrity of the system, because with that kind of volume and bulk, the system can easily spin out of control and be perceived as an abuse. And we've all seen the newspaper articles. Debtor files bankruptcy and drives Hummer and keeps Hummer. And we know there's a reason why that might have been allowed, but the public doesn't. So anyway, my point is this. We're also, I think, all very cognizant of there's things we'd like to do, but we need to maintain this integrity of the system so that the public and our government our citizenry have confidence that we are enforcing the system the way it has been passed by Congress. And as you mentioned, I mean, I'm the same way. I don't know if Congress will ever touch bankruptcy again with a 10-foot pole. But it really is, it means if there's changes, and there are enormous changes, I mean, payment to Chapter 7 attorneys, debtor's counsel, I think is a huge problem. Not discharge, maybe, but certainly facilitating repayment of student loans through Chapter 13 plan could be done. A lot of legislation that needs to be done, I don't know what it happened, but it's not our role, per se, to legislate those changes.
I got two things I have to say. First of all, I couldn't agree with you more about the potential improvement of consumer bankruptcy if Congress would be willing to look at some particular problem areas. And we're going to have an ABI commission to do that. And I hope the people around this table will be willing to give ideas to those commissioners and perhaps even participate in a hearing or two. But the other thing I wanted to say is that when you first talk about the question of complying with the law rather than interjecting your own political views, that just really hit home to me because it's so important. This notion of a rule of law, that you really can go back to what the words of a statute or a constitutional provision really mean and not play games to make it come out the way you really like to. It's a temptation. I think a lot of people were disappointed with what BAPSIPA did to bankruptcy practice. A lot of judges would be tempted to interpret provisions in that set of amendments in a way that would appear to be different from what the words said. And that's really dangerous because even though it might produce a good result in the short term, it has this overall policy of undermining the predictive capability and the integrity of the legal system. So I just really, it hit me that you were really right about that. It's really important.
And hard at times.
The Supreme Court can do it.
Yeah. There's some questions back behind you, Judge McNamara.
Well, I'm not quite sure. I think it's good that there's diversity amongst the judges on the bench about how they handle particular issues. I don't view that as a downside. I think that different judges rule differently in part based on what their background is and the kinds of issues that they've addressed when they were in private practice. And that has something to do with it. And when the listserv, the debtor's listserv, which I'm not on that, but when they start talking about how the judges are ruling, and they say, oh, well, this is different, and so-and-so rules differently than somebody else, and this is what you do in front of them versus what you do from somebody else. I mean, they have a listserv about the trustees, too. And
the judges have a listserv.
That's right.
Gave up the secrets.
Well, I'll just turn my name back to them.
You make an excellent point, and I agree with you completely. And that's part of why we wanted to do this. We did the introduction so you could see the real diversity of experience. And, you know, we're over at the Judge McNamara's office, and he has all this memorabilia from Russia. And I said, what are you doing? Oh, he's over there speaking and talking. You know, it's like, wow, that's nothing I've ever done. So this breadth of experience, while individually it impacts our decisions, as we add to the body of law based on our perspectives, you're right, that diversity is a set. I agree with you completely.
But it's
I want
at
everyone
all,
to think exactly.
It's at all levels of the system. It's at the trustee level. It's at the creditors level. It's at the debtors' counsel level. Everybody does something differently.
But frequently
you're going to have people say, well, I've never had another trustee ask for me to do this. You're the first one who's ever asked me to do that. And like Judge McNamara, I once had a debtor who attached an email from her counsel to a plea about me, and the debtor's counsel said that I wasn't the most pleasant person in the world. But
were you the worst trustee in all of Colorado?
That's the list service conclusion, right? But you know, you see that going through, when you're making decisions, whether you're making them as a judge or as a creditor's counsel or as a debtor's counsel or as a trustee, if you're worried about something outside the particular facts of that case, I don't think that's the right way to make the decision. You make it just within that particular case based on what the information that you have, and then you move on. I think this kind of diversity is important, and I think that it helps practitioners as they appear in front of the court and see how judges do things differently. There's the bankruptcy code is complex, and there's always something that you can learn from going to court and being in front of a different judge.
I want to just bust in and clarify something, because I advocated for some uniformity earlier, but I agree with what you said too. And here's how I justify those two things together. I greatly respect my colleagues in Colorado and throughout the country, and when I'm faced with a decision, certainly review what they have done and their analysis, and if it's compelling it will maybe drive me in a certain direction. But I'm not looking for uniformity and for uniformity's sake on decisions. Mm-hmm. I think we have to independently look at each of the legal issues, and that diversity is good on decisions, and then it can go up through the appellate system, and there can be, you know, our colleagues in the district court and the BAP and the circuit and others can take a look at those and see what the reasoning is from different perspectives and choose maybe the best reasoning. But where uniformity, I think, makes a lot of sense is on just procedural issues. You know, an order on a pretrial scheduling conference. You know, why do we have five different pretrial scheduling conference orders? That doesn't make much sense. And I don't think a diversity in that, you know, one judge might take an additional 3 months to order the trial versus another one that goes a little quicker. That, to me, that's not the diversity. That's an area where I think that we can look better for uniformity, and that would help the system. So just a little bit of a comment there.
You know, I really agree with that, but I am aware of at least one district in the country where the judges feel that they really ought to be uniform on all their substantive rulings as well. And that's the District of Oregon. The judges there came to an agreement themselves that they would circulate the opinions that they're going to issue to all the judges, and that if nobody disagrees, then that opinion gets issued, and all the other judges will follow it. Now, I come from Chicago, where people tend to have very strong and antagonistic views. I mean, we have the White Sox and the Cubs, and I was in the White Sox game this year, and you know, I don't agree with my Cubs and Cubs. But the point I want to get at is there's some lively discussion that can take place when you're not required to agree with every opinion that's come down in the district. And so as much as I love the judges in Oregon, I thought that's probably not the best way to go. And the same thing as far as district court opinions. I think it's right to say that we're not bound by them. And I also think that bad opinions, even though they can be very persuasive, are probably not binding because they're not binding on the district court. So I'm thinking that that kind of foment that comes up with different opinions that ultimately can come to a court of appeals or even to the Supreme Court, that's a good thing. And I'm very much in agreement with that.
But uniformity on procedural matters.
Yeah, you ought to get treated procedurally in very similar ways without regard to the courtroom you're walking into. You know, this is talking about the state court in Chicago, which was a very strange thing. I walked into a courtroom one day and I thought, oh my God, this is nothing I learned in law school. The judge was there in some matter involving the Catholic Church in Chicago, and he announced to the lawyers, I want to see the cardinal here tomorrow. we'll settle this. But, wow, is he in the power to do that?
Anytime there's advocacy by the judges, I think that that's also adversarial. So the situation that I question is, I understand there will be some advocacy. What is the requirement of due process on the judiciary if there are going to be advocates?
I think that's why we try to avoid it.
Well, see, it brings up like this objection to the proof of claim. That's a simple one, but trustee or somebody filed the objection to the proof of claim. You probably didn't think on its face, so I take it there. You were probably taking a position for the claim.
I didn't know what position. The problem was I didn't know what position to take, because why do I want to force them to pay something they don't owe, because that jacks up an entire plan? I mean, so it wasn't like a position, it was more of a, but it was a burden. It, you know, there's still all the case laws, it's, you know, if you want to file, you have to have enough proof to, you know, it's just that kind of custody. I don't know that we're, if it's advocacy, but it's tough when you're in that fine line. Like,
the question is, yeah, if there is a role or some advocacy taken, is there a due process requirement on the court?
I'm just going to answer for myself, and I think yes, because again, we talked about Judge Bolden, where he used to come in on uncontested matters, and she would have all kinds of issues, and you weren't prepared to discuss them. And I appreciated her diligence, but it could sometimes be frustrating. So even though I see those situations come up, I make an effort to try and say, look, these are the problems I have, and I'll give you an opportunity to brief it or address it, or we can argue it, but I'm not going to rule against you and kind of cold clock you at the same time. So at least I try to avoid that.
I agree with that. I agree with you. Judge Brown, I thought you might have mentioned one this morning about it was a 523 action and you could tell on its face that it was just a breach of contract. Do you remember that?
Yes. I would never do that without a notice hearing that told them what my issue was. Then they come in or give them a chance to brief it if it's something complex.
Okay, so you would give notice, you would
absolutely
explain your position and
yes.
Then.
Yeah, you try to give everybody the opportunity to at least have a say. And somebody pretty much an issue they're not aware of, and so it just isn't kind of to surprise someone. The other aspect of advocacy we were talking about this morning is when the judge gets active in a case. And I think to a certain extent, a lot of that may be a sliding scale. From my vantage point, when you've got two lawyers, competent lawyers, arguing, you're a lot less active, you let them do their craft. That's what they're paid to do. That's you listen and you enjoy and you take their input. You don't impose yourself in the middle of that. Where the difficulty starts hitting us, and Judge McNamara mentioned this morning in connection with what you did with pro se, or a situation a lot of times comes up when you've got a brand new lawyer against a seasoned lawyer, and you can see that the seasoned lawyer is just doing circles around the young lawyer. And that's when you start to figure, okay, now what are we dealing with? Is the idea justice on a level playing field? Because it's not a level playing field. Or do you just let it play out and the young lawyer is just going to get his licks and that's the way it works? And that's the hardest time as a judge when you're sitting there as, okay, do I need to impose myself into this and maybe help them with the requirements of a contract dispute or something along those lines? Or do you just sit back and basically say, okay, you're going to lose this one, and maybe you'll just learn because of the licks you're taking this time. And that's very, very difficult as a judge as to when you draw that line.
I'll say a difference in bankruptcy than other federal laws is there is an overarching policy here that, to spill the water on yourself, is that the honest debtor receives a discharge of debts. And so are we advocating on behalf of the client, or are we advocating to fulfill the responsibility or to fill the charge of the bankruptcy? And that's where I think there is a slight difference that when somebody says, well, you favor the debtors. Well, I think that's the overarching policy of the code is the honest, sincere debtor is entitled to a fresh start.
But I don't even like the phrase judicial advocacy. I mean, I hope that I'm never a judicial advocate of anything. I know that it was, and so this morning. But it struck me wrong this morning, and if that's what I'm doing, then I think I'm doing something wrong, because I'm not trying to advocate for any particular side, but to decide the issue that is presented. Now, sometimes, in the gatekeeping function, we might have issues. I think it's fairly rare. I had one, I think maybe some people in the room were involved with, as an example, in the Chapter 13, a husband and wife, where the husband died 2 weeks after the case was filed. Everyone continued to proceed on in their, you know, with the case as normal, to propose a plan even though he was deceased. And there was no objection raised by the Chapter 13 trustee's office. I raised the issue, but like Judge Brown asked for a briefing and felt very very seriously that there should be an opportunity for due process to get a full vetting of the issue. And for example, if there's a question that's raised, and we talked about this morning, if I ask a question during an evidentiary hearing, I'm always going to, after asking that question, make sure that both sides have an opportunity to follow up if they need to ask further questions because of my question. If there's just one last thing on advocacy, if judicial advocacy also means case management, then I think that I might be a judicial advocate, because I don't want cases to just sit there for a long time. And so I do aggressively try to manage cases and reduce the docket of cases that don't need to be there. I've reduced our adversary proceedings in our court from 130 to 48 now. And that's, I think, in part by aggressively managing the cases to a result. And I do feel strongly about that.
That's another question, by the way, that could be asked of the judges. What is your policy regarding continuances of trials at the request of the parties jointly? And I personally followed the same idea that Judge McNamara did, and that is we set a deadline and we hold to it. Unless one of us is in the hospital, we're going to go ahead with the trial. And that, to me, encouraged settlement far more than the parties saying, well, we're pretty close. If you just give us another couple of weeks, maybe we can reach agreement. Well, then a couple of weeks turns a couple of months, or maybe a year. It's really better to have the deadline honored. And then that would be something that people in the community basically know. You're not going to get a continuance just because you say you're in settlement discussions.
What are other responsibilities to ensure that you don't miss your break? I hope you feel like you're